Welcome back to the CTO Playbook, the podcast dedicated to helping CTOs excel. I'm your host, Adam Horner. Today's guest is Todd Zeno, a seasoned CTO, startup advisor, and fractional executive who's been through it all, from scaling tech teams, moving across continents, and no less than five M&A deals. In this episode, we'll be talking about the changing landscape of tech leadership, especially for CTOs at the junctions between product management, software engineering, and leadership. We discussed the squeeze on CPOs and CTOs in smaller organizations, how individual contributors are becoming more self-sufficient with new tools and approaches, and why CTOs need to widen their scope to survive. Todd also shares his insights on the rise of fractional leadership, the future of AI and tech ecosystem, and what it takes to stay ahead as a modern CTO. If you've ever wondered how to stay relevant and effective as a tech leader in today's fast-moving environment, this conversation is packed with actionable advice, real-world stories, and some bold predictions. Todd, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us on the podcast. It's great to have you here.
Yes, it's an absolute honor and pleasure to be here today, Adam.
Let's start learning a little bit about you, your personal journey. So how did you first get involved in tech? What was the thing that first sort of magnetized you into it? And then what led you to where you are today as a CTO?
Brilliant question. So I started in the United States. Classic comp sci mathematics background, but I graduated right around the time of the dot-com boom, the original one from the aughts. So I wasn't sure I wanted to go into startup world. Some of my friends dropped out to move to San Francisco and I did not follow them. I actually worked in academia trying to get a graduate degree and working for the IT department of Cornell University for a while. So I didn't really catch the startup bug till 5 years after uni. And I went through a rapid succession of New York City-based startups where, you know, I found myself either the tech lead or sole engineer. The only one of note that amounted to anything was a company called Demdex, where I built effectively what became Adobe Audience Manager when Adobe acquired the company. And scarily, some of my code might still be in production 12 years later. But that's kind of what I would call phase one. And I think the process of doing that, where I built so much IP, but I did not make any significant percentage of the $100 million exit value that Demdex had to Adobe because I was not good at the commercial side or negotiating my equity going in. And that's where I learned, okay, with what I have gotten as upside from this, I really want to understand a business from the inside out. And that led to me co-founding Wallaby after I left Demdex, which actually required moving from New York to Los Angeles. It was a complete life change. And since then, yeah, I've been a CTO of one type or another, whether through fortune, misfortune, just great learnings. In the 12 years I've been a CTO, I've been a co-founder with nothing, you know, starting from scratch. I've managed to sell that and then be, you know, I oversee a network of 120 across product and tech with my original co-founder because we did a reorg after we sold the company. And then have that further take me on some M&A journeys where I came abroad to the UK. I've also been at some Series B scale-ups, you know, where the headcount was around 30 or 40, but then had to do crisis management as well as, you know, the actual scale-up part of it. So yeah, there's been some successes along the way. There's been a lot of hard learnings. There's been five M&As, which is crazy to think, looking back on it, both on the buy and sell side. But it's given me a great diversity of experience where, like, I know what it's like to be a co-founding CTO, a scale-up CTO, a business unit leader of 100, you know, a publicly traded company where the regulatory and, you know, commercial considerations are vastly different than when you're venture backed. So it's all given me great learnings to see what themes are common and what themes, you know, are just very different based on the operating environment that you're in.
Yeah, and quite a bit of relocation there as well. So going from coast to coast in the US and then from LA to UK.
Yeah, and it's, again, it's a funny thing. You'll probably touch on this, like there's Silicon Valley and there's everything else. So, you know, I've now had of the top five, you know, venture, you know, cities like Los Angeles, New York, and London, you know, tend to hover somewhere around the top five or 10. But then there's a point where, like, you're either considered a Silicon Valley person where you jump around from Apple to Google to the latest YC, you know, scale up, or you work in those other markets. And so, yeah, I decided, probably at this point, I'll never become a Silicon Valley person. And I'm completely at peace with that because I don't think necessarily the intelligence or tech capability is radically different. It's just the scale and breadth. It's just so all over the place, you know, you kind of get thrown into the storm if you're there.
Yeah, and the speed of Silicon Valley is just something else, isn't it? Yeah. So I've done a bit of that sort of hypergrowth as well. I was working for Palantir, obviously a Silicon Valley company, but I was mostly based in the UK and witnessed the growth in the UK and in the team from there. But going through hypergrowth, growing at that speed, this brings a whole bunch of different aspects you don't get in any other part of the growth phase of the startups. What was your sort of experience with those?
Yeah, I think it's always, you know, a sudden jolt when you're no longer, it's one team, one dream, and, you know, you're still, you know, the product is changing every single day to you have to consider making something work for a $500 million P&L. My hypergrowth was interesting that it wasn't an investor coming in saying, here's $20 million, go and, you know, hire like crazy. It was, We bought your company, and now our parent company is on fire. Everything's broken. The tech is 20 years old. So we've got a $500 million P&L. We are profitable and there's lots of revenue, but it's literally falling apart. Can you completely rethink how we do our technology, how we build our data, and still keep, you know, the brand and commercial going? So we had a chance to hire, you know, 40 people over that span across two offices. So it was very much like you would have gotten, but the type of negotiations you were doing had like a board component, you know, at a publicly traded company, but the mandate was good. They realized they needed radical change and we became the vehicle for that radical change. So,
wow, it's kind of rescaffolding the company from the inside out.
Exactly. It was like the best of both worlds where you got to experience a scale up, but you were in the umbrella of a publicly traded company. So it wasn't like you had more safety. If anything worse, you know, you're looking at the stock value every day and making sure the earnings calls don't spook, you know, them from finishing what they started. But no, that was just an incredible journey. And the fact that it was still based on the core leadership principles and, you know, technology my co-founder and I had developed, and it actually worked in a very different environment was pleasantly surprising. But obviously there were a lot of learnings along the way, just due to the people and commercial and legacy complexity we were suddenly accountable for.
Yeah, brilliant. And you've also been on the other side of that growth phase as well, sort of downscaling in size. So what sort of drove towards that levels and how is that different from the growth side of it?
Yeah, it's I think it's a learning people should go through, which is, you know, and I see this when I talk to executive recruiters, like, do you hire somebody who's been a really great middle management operator at Facebook or, you know, Google, but has not had to actually deal with that neutron bomb situation? I did not ask to deal with it twice, but yeah, in London, over a 4-year span, I was twice hired by a Series B stage company to help them raise a Series C. And right after I got there, an act of God happened. You know, in one case, it was the founder being sacked by the board. In the second case, it was an insurtech where the underwriters pulled out based on previous year's performance. And so what was supposed to be, let's rapidly tee up to hire more and, you know, expand our growth capability and expand into multiple markets outside the UK became, how can we keep revenue going up with costs going down? And again, in both cases, I was lucky to have a board that was not cut everything to the bone and put it on ice. So I was able to do, you know, I inherited a lot of overpriced contractors in the first situation. So just transitioning to a full-time org by itself, you know, saved 30% in overhead. But the fact that I could culturally evolve that org to, you know, operate as 4 or 5 teams of that headcount rather than 2, I was able to get a wider remit deployed, you know, at what the board saw as an acceptable cost. And we were able to double revenue while, you know, lowering cost. But it still wasn't enough to save the company from, you know, hitting a runway wall during the pandemic. So we still had to take an M&A outcome that was not, you know, super ideal. In the second case of the insurtech, again, you know, we agreed with the board on a 20% across the board cut. But again, I saw ways to actually develop, and this was a theme we'll get back into later in this discussion, you know, smaller teams with, you know, able to remit faster so we could do, you know, 4 things in parallel rather than 3. And nothing fell apart because I had to, you know, bring along the journey that if we split things up in this way, yes, there'll be a lower ratio of PM to engineers, but that'll be a good thing because it'll force us to really prioritize and think about the tweaks we can make to the estate to get what we need. So again, I think creative thinking is important. And obviously nobody wants to, you know, tech goes from the savior to the cost center overnight, you know, based on one act of God. And you have to be able to not turn defensive with that. You have to be able to work with that.
And understanding the finances as well, because I think in many cases in the growth environment, you've got this kind of very loose idea of where the finances are. But then when it's going the other direction, you suddenly become hyper-focused on those financial numbers and suddenly Excel becomes your best friend. And
yeah. And I don't think that's too different. Like if more like publicly traded companies actually have to report capital expenditure. And we were very good at doing that with Bankrate, that we could prove the amount of money we had sunk into that hiring wave was actually CapEx. And we reported our monthly capital project, which went directly to the board CFO. I actually think more startups would benefit from that. They always have that financial model that they're tweaking, but often it's not split to really understand those trade-offs and explain, you know, that your tech team is not just overhead. It actually is the engine at which you can achieve better growth. But then you are absolutely have to tie the team efforts to those top line, you know, customer cost to acquire customer, you know, lifetime value, and prove that the work you're doing iteratively is going to improve that. It's not just going to be features that we hope show in lagging KPIs a year later.
Absolutely. Yeah. We could probably spend an entire hour talking about all those financial metrics and how you make sure that you track them carefully. But what I wanted to do is sort of focus on something else. We see all the ones that you mentioned so far, those roles were all full-time roles, were they not? Because I think at the moment you're now sort of running fractional and part-time. Is that right?
Correct. And I think you've touched on this in the past, like some people set out to be consultants and some people, you know, find themselves bored doing that by accident. I'm closer to the latter camp. I never had an ambition to be a fractional CTO, but I was always interested in doing advisory and board roles due to the fact I'd worked with a lot of startups. And I think the moment we're in, which we'll get into the details of, like this is things are radically changing in terms of how tech leadership, how product and tech capabilities are fitting together. So this is a good time to be doing that. We're in an environment where we're just not seeing as many good tech leadership opportunities. And I think it's really, I would much rather be trying to do more and deliver more value and learn more about businesses than put myself back in a, you know, early stage management or, you know, half IC management role, which is unfortunately what a lot of early stage startup CT roles are like. So again, it's not trying to be mercenary by any means. It's to make sure I'm continuing my learning journey. And, you know, certainly if somebody offers me to be CTO of a unicorn tomorrow, I might happily roll up and go do that because I think that'd be a great continuation of my journey. But if those roles are not, you know, in the market as much as they were before, or don't have the right vibe about the business, I'd rather keep trying to build my own startup as well as, you know, consult and help, you know, three or four different companies. And one of them could suddenly have a need for that to turn into full-time because, oh my God, they've cracked the code. There is a 30 or 40 million pound investment, you know, and maybe my ideal role is to help them hire the right long-term fit, or maybe I can transition to that long-term fit. So I think it's a good, it's not strictly for people who've given up on full-time or, you know, don't like it anymore. I think it really is about how you're going to learn more. And again, I think it's a demand side issue right now, especially the CTO world. Wallaby, when 12 years ago, used a fractional CFO and a fractional CMO because that's what we needed as a seed stage startup. On all the fractional communities I'm on, and anybody who's done fractional or tried to get into fractional CTO and will see this, the demand for fractional CMOs and CFOs is like 10x the demand for fractional CTOs. And I think there's just a gap in what executives expect tech to be. And I think we can get into why that is, because again, like they're at peace with that fractional CMO because they know launching a campaign, you have to let it play out, you know, for a week or two or a month. CFOs, you have to review the model, you know, performance over the horizon of a week or a month, not every day. I don't think tech is that different. It shouldn't be. Like if your tech estate is such a mess that every day there needs to be an intervention at a small team size, something is just fundamentally wrong. You know, tech boards have been doing agile sprints forever. So why you wouldn't want to make sure on a weekly basis the sprint is calibrated correctly, that the right conversations are being had. But then there's a point where, okay, the rest of the week, you've got to let them focus and get on with it. And like, I think, yeah, the gap is venture capital backed businesses I find the most. I think bootstrap businesses get it because often they bootstrapped by being fractional consultants, you know, to get their, you know, grocery money while they were in that phase. And private equity, I think weirdly understands it too, because they're used to a portfolio mentality. So they often have like a portfolio CTO or chief digital officer who might need to intervene for a while if one company is more of a mess than another. And they understand, you know, sometimes that company just needs that weekly check-in to make sure the transformation plan, you know, has the right head of engineering or, you know, head of transformation, but is still looking at the bigger picture. So I think it's the venture-backed businesses, the ones raising those Series A, B, and C, that just still have this gap that they think tech is this volatile thing that needs adult supervision, you know, 24/7, lest the engineers go off the reservation. And I think that just fundamentally fails to understand what motivates modern engineers, especially product engineers, senior product engineers, and what motivates, you know, CTOs as well, or CPOs, or people who want to do both roles.
And yeah, but that's something that we probably worth digging into, because do you think that's something that's actually changed over time, that engineers, engineering teams, product teams have got to the point where they actually need less hands-on oversight than they used to 5, 10, 15 years ago? Do you think that's actually changed? Or do you think it's just a perception, as you said, from particularly from the VCs, that is needed to be hands-on and in there?
Yeah, I think it's a lagging and leading indicator. Like capabilities have increased. The notion of classifying somebody as a product engineer and what that means, I think there's a gap sometimes that a platform engineer is any different. I think I'm one of the radical opinion that somebody should operate as a PM for data teams and for product, you know, platform teams as well. And I often go into companies where like any team with a customer facing remit has a really great PM. And then there's like a engineering manager in charge of developing the roadmap and priorities for the platform team, feeding them APIs or, you know, infrastructure. And I actually think the same commercial, you know, customer prioritization and design for, you know, tactics should be used, you know, on the internal stuff as much as it is on the external. So with that gap aside, yeah, I think teams have become very agile and, you know, PMs and whoever the designated tech lead is for a team have become, you know, reasonably, there's good relationships, or that's where you fix the problems when you come in. But I think this idea that every day there's volatility, like, yeah, when you get to a width of like 7 or 8 teams, something's always wrong. Like if everything was right, it would be suspicious. But if it's still, you know, a remit of like 2 teams, you know, or 2 or 3, usually you should expect them to like have a good understanding of their interdependencies, where they can run fully autonomously, and, you know, how they can get on, even if there's like commercial interventions that have to happen, you know, it doesn't radically change the thesis of what they've set out to develop for the next week or so.
And have you got some examples of sort of literally of teams where you've been able to go in and change the team structure and they've actually basically have an impact on the sophistication of the way that they're running?
Yes, I think anywhere, both the examples I alluded to earlier at the Series B, even with the haircut we had to take, you know, to just keep operating under the board's, you know, approval, there was a chance. So, and again, it often is on those areas that don't at first seem producty. Yeah. So again, to name some names, you know, Trussell was a mortgage broker that had a massive operational component because we were trying to make a really great customer experience where you got, you know, what seemed like white glove service, everything was digital, you weren't going into an office and filling out paperwork. But underneath that, you know, was a really great onboarding journey and then a lot of just random operational tooling, you know, in the background. And, you know, one of the first things I did was bring a product mindset to that. One of the best PMs we had who had been building the journey actually had exactly the right mindset to think about the internal colleague tooling. And we set out to completely transform, you know, what was possible. It was just all bespoke, you know, JavaScript admin tooling. We were doing a lot of reinvention of the wheel of classic CRM stuff. So both, you know, picking a vendor where we could abstract the commodity, but still write the thing that made it very unique to mortgages and the mortgage process, and really apply a product mindset to that. And I was able to still make sure we were delivering onboarding journeys with a different PM and still servicing, you know, the kind of mortgage lending business we were getting into. So yeah, I think it's often you need to make those product interventions where at first, you know, the classic product vision is all about what the customer journey looks like from the customer's point of view. And so much more goes into that. With the InsurTech, it was the same idea. Pricing was seen as like a data science exercise, and the CEO was still uploading his own pricing spreadsheets, you know, into a JavaScript engine, and actually bringing a product mindset. How do you bring all these different insurance data sets together and think about, you know, almost like it's an internal software as a service, and bring that same product mindset to it? And so, yeah, somebody was doing a business analyst role, we, you know, designated into a product manager when he had exactly, again, the right mindset to build an internal system, really understand the customer need that was still going to lead to a much better end user outcome from better quotes, more accurate quotes, and, you know, better renewal experience, because we had all the data that would go into how we offered them a policy renewal. But again, because it required that abstraction from just the frontline customer experience into what internal, I think that's something companies miss over and over again and always surprised by it. And often it is about bringing more PMs in and really thinking, even at that stage, there needs to be a couple of internal teams really solving for an outcome that's going to allow the product, the customer-facing teams to deliver even better journeys or propositions or, you know, et cetera.
Because I think for the average CTO, they probably don't necessarily think about that. Because if I try and summarize what you basically did was, you basically reduced cost and reduced complexity by expanding scope. And by expanding scope, you're able to streamline a lot more because you take some of the historical spinning the wheels operational processes away by streamlining it, automating it, productizing it, standardizing it, which is effectively an expansion of scope. I mean, have I understood it roughly right?
Yes. And I think that is, again, why I sometimes worry people who stay too much in the head of engineering, you know, track and then want to become a CTO, or the kind of head of design, head of product and want to become a CPO. They miss the forest for the trees with that, you know, about thinking about the underlying capabilities. And I think the classic thing is how we think about tech debt. You know, tech debt's supposed to be this thing, oh, servers are crashing or the app is slowing down, we've got to do something. That's usually less like, so from one perspective at the InsurTech, there was this perception, well, we have no tech debt because everything has great uptime. The CFO loves, you know, the overall budget of, you know, how we've assigned headcount. But like, there were like three different ways to do CRM, four different ways to do the customer journey on different, you know, content stacks. And that made it really hard if you wanted to say there's a product team whose responsibility is renewals. Well, that touches like the application experience. It touches the onboarding, you know, web experience. And yeah, so like within a team, there was good autonomy and, you know, yeah, you could rationalize that iteration was fast because, and that there was no tech debt from that one lens, but there was a lot of product debt that was actually tech debt as well. So I think understanding where tech debt's not a matter of just things slowing down or things crashing, it actually is, are you able to do the right sort of product slices without either requiring engineers to know seven different systems where that's not necessary? And, you know, are you doing too many different ways of collecting data, moving data around, communicating with customers? If you're using like seven different tools, half of which are buried in code or homegrown, that's a massive problem. A lot of businesses become CRM businesses the larger they get, you know, where it all becomes about the...
It all tends towards the same sort of scenario.
Operational support journey or the customer journey. It's you almost, even when you start out as a fintech, you know, cool app or a really cool insurtech or health tech, you kind of become a CRM business of some scale. And you'll have these CTOs, oh, we're using Salesforce. Yeah, I survive it because they asked me to go implement a Salesforce integration. And then it's somebody else's problem. I'm like, no, like ultimately that's going to be like, what the layer between customer communication and your core technology and app capability, like getting that right at scale is one of the most important things. And you kind of need a product, commercial, operational, and tech mindset to understand that problem and solve for, not just a really good tech mindset.
Which I think is one of the key things, like widening that scope mentally, personally, of whether you're looking at product, whether you're looking at technology, whether you're looking at data. It's actually, it almost doesn't matter. You need to have a scope on all three of those things pretty much all the time. Because I think sometimes when you're talking about tech debt there, my brain was immediately translating that into product debt. Actually, you know, that there's this lack of design thinking on a bigger, grander scale than you need in order to be able to reduce the kind of duplication, double work, multiple standards, et cetera, to sort of get from A to B.
Now, when you think about product engineering getting more sophisticated, being able to do more with less engineers, my advice is to allow the leaders to go wider rather than go deeper, because there's actually less depth to manage. Like, it's not a matter of trying to scale to infinity. Like, if your app, you know, in auto cloud environments, you know, what works for 100 requests a second might easily work for 10,000 requests a second without a lot of re-architecture. So I think there's this need for leaders to understand that, you know, aspiring tech leaders have to go wider. They have to spend more time with their operational counterparts, even take on big operational or marketing or, you know, product responsibilities at times, you know, working with the right CMO or stakeholder, than just see themselves as a delivery mechanism for the aspirations of the rest of the C-suite team and just give good estimations and good uptime, you know, on those things.
Cool. So one of the things you've been speaking about as well, which is very closely related to that, is this sort of the squeeze, as you call it, on the sort of the CPO, CTO, especially in smaller organizations. So where do you think that is coming from, and how does that sort of relate to the scope question?
Yeah, it's a really brilliant question. I think, again, the canary in the coal mine was the CPOs. I think there was a great resignation that started to happen, even as there was a kind of brief post-pandemic VC splurge, which is now completely inverted, you know, in the past year. But there's like three inescapable trends going on. I think the product and tech roles are converging more because you have to apply a product mindset to a lot of like core back office and infrastructure. And you have to have a really good tech mindset for developing great product and design. And now with AI, you can literally generate code with a good design thing. You don't have to do as much, you know. So I think that's one thing. I think post this inversion of zero interest rate environment, headcounts are plummeting. So there's an idea of how do we do more with less? And that's going to affect the leadership role as well. So I think a lot of CPOs at first felt squeezed because ultimately, if there's still a founding CEO, they are the custodian of the product vision. And the CPO's job is to try to articulate that into a roadmap. But the CTO, who might understand product and commercial well enough, is the one holding 80% of the resources. And so you just end up with a lot of disconnect at the C-suite level, that's fatal. You know, if you're a company the size of Just Eat, where you, you know, combine product and tech have 2,000 heads, of course, you're probably going to need executives. But if your combined product tech headcount is under, you know, 300, I think that's becoming less and less necessary to have those be different roles, especially if ultimately the CEO is really driving a vision. And then there needs to be, how do you deliver that and make the right bets on core capability and very fast iteration of customer tests and learning? And I think that has to be done either by the best CPO, CTO, you know, hive mind, or by somebody being willing to take on that role and not lose focus and have a good kind of senior management team below them where they're training the next generation of like head of product, head of engineering to think more holistically. So yeah, I think CPOs saw it first, but I think CTOs are feeling it now too, because their headcounts are getting squoze, and the ICs they're working for them are now architects. Like, you know, a senior engineer with 5 years of experience, I've seen brilliant people with that experience actually developing great architecture because they've seen enough of what looks good. They can, you know, with infrastructure as code, with like the tooling, they understand it enough. They don't need 10 or 15 years of experience. They're not trying to solve for reinventing the cloud because they're not inside of Google where, you know, the cost of a data center or the amount of parallel traffic is just like in the stratosphere. It's different than what most venture-backed companies are experiencing. So now CTOs are feeling it. There's a CPO deciding all the what and why, and I'm just getting squeezed about managing the how and when. And yet I've got a great principal engineer or two of them who are actually making a lot of the key architectural decisions. So what am I doing, you know, for that time if I can't take a wider remit? And I felt that squeeze a couple of times. Like, the last thing I want to do is micromanage a really brilliant senior engineer or, you know, up-and-coming engineering manager. If I think they know their business really well, my job is to challenge them to grow faster. But if there's ultimately somebody else in charge of the roadmap and I'm just there to kind of calibrate delivery, that can be demotivating sometimes, unless, you know, there's just such a large org and so many geographies, there's just so much culture building and, you know, tech architecture to consider, even when things are all going well and the strategy is locked in.
And I think this is part of the push towards fractional roles as well, because when you've got people who are further down the org chart who are so capable, then if you don't need all that time, what are you going to do with the rest of your time? Well, either you go work for other customers, or you, as you say, you widen your remit to look at the product aspects as well.
Yeah, and that goes back to the demand side. I think you need founders who have that mindset and understand that. I don't know where this high, because like I know a lot of VCs and they say, we don't get that operationally. Like we're there for board meetings. You know, we're so busy. We give them a Series A check. And as long as they, you know, report to the board every month, like, yeah, VCs are not micromanaging most companies unless they make a decision to fire a founder because it's so off plan, which I've experienced, you know, firsthand. So it's not VCs telling them to get a certain type of CTO. I really think just founders are in these Slack networks or reading conventional wisdom. And they're like, I need somebody I can like tap on the shoulder 5 days a week and whiteboard my latest, you know, anxiety. And I think that's also a maturity thing for founders. Like you're not going to lock in a Gantt chart for 3 years and set it and forget it. But like you're doing the other extreme. If you have to constantly rethink or second guess every decision, you know, you committed to, you know, at the beginning of the week or at the beginning of the kind of monthly plan, that's a problem as well. So I think it almost, there's a class of founders that can't help themselves and worry that we're fractional. They're not going to get somebody who really understands them. And, you know, whereas they should be more ruthless with their time and maximize that 1 or 2 days. And then I think for a certain class of CTO, they never want to get away from the code in the first place. They want a higher title. They want a little more pay. They want a little more insight into if the company's screwed or not, in which they get by having the CTO role. But at heart, they still want to be the smartest coder in the room and, you know, mentor ICs. And nothing against those people. I think there's you can make your peace doing that. Yeah, but you're going to hit a ceiling in what you learn. So yeah, I think there's too many CTOs willing to just say, I'm a coding CTO who does occasional management and occasional sparring with the CEO. And there's too many founders who just think like, unlike their fractional CMO or CFO or, you know, board advisor, they feel like they need a 5 day a week, you know, intervention or, you know, because they're so worried the engineers are building the wrong thing or, you know, don't get the strategy. And I think that's those two pressures.
Because I think one of the things that I always talk about is the fact that the CTO role really is only about 40 years old. And so I think part of this is also an element of, I mean, you talked about the maturity of the tooling, of the technology, of the, you know, how well known the architectures and approaches are. But I also think there is just a maturing of the understanding of what the role is of a CTO. It's literally just professionalizing in front of us as we're working. And as a result of that, CTOs themselves are becoming more efficient at the job. So they're either able to take on that wider scope or they're able to do the same things that a CTO did 4 or 5 years ago. Because they've got patterns and approaches that are just pretty much copyable off the shelf, there isn't as much thinking new approaches or totally novel that needs to be applied to the role. Is that something that you see the same of as well?
Yeah, and I think that's a great example of everything coming full circle. Like you said, you know, 40 years ago, there was this idea of a CIO in charge of the whole IT department. And yeah, a lot of people cringe when they hear those words, but that ultimately that did encompass all the reporting, the engineering, the IT, the product management, as that was understood at the time before that became a sexy career path, you know, after Google. And then you got into this phase where, okay, there's so much digital, everything's now digitally native. So we need like a rock star CTO, a rock star CPO, even a rock star data science, you know, chief data scientist. And now I think we're going to the other side of that, where those capabilities have matured enough that actually one person should be able to handle, you know, the data product. So like the chief digital officer, I almost think the CIO role is coming back, but being rebranded as like a chief digital officer to modernize it so it doesn't get pigeonholed as like a dreary IT governance type role. But I think we're coming full circle.
And also that it separates it in terms of scope.
Exactly. So yeah, I think everything old is new again to some extent, but I also think it is a recognition of those capabilities. You know, when you get to, when a company goes public, often you've just got, you know, the COO who's kind of the deputy CEO at that point by, you know, the name. You got the CFO who's making all the board and like kind of external IR reporting. And then the often there's a CTO is not even on the masthead. You know, there is one, but they're considered like the next level of like C-suite, or somebody's rolled into that kind of chief strategy officer type role, in which case they really are overseeing, you know, the product tech and digital function.
Yeah, and I see that more and more often actually.
So yeah, I don't think it's new. I just think it's coming back and possibly coming earlier in the journey, which would, again, like Reid Hoffman, everybody's going to be in like a fractional strategic role. You know, so there's one set, I think, coming from very influential people. But when I look on the ground, I still see the overall majority, and I see what comes into my inbox from executive recruiters. They're looking for that full-time early stage CTO who is like mostly coding and occasionally leading. And I just think it's a bad habit and it's not cost effective for what that company needs at their level of funding.
And I think, because I think the other thing we're seeing is a reduction in the total number of CTOs available in the market. I think there's quite a few people who have, you know, gone through the last few years of downsizing, reduction and so on. And they've kind of realized that because there aren't that many CTO roles needed, because the majority of them are in startups, like statistically, you know, the most CTOs there are going to be in small startups where they're individual contributors. So the number of strategic CTOs who've managed multiple teams of multiple engineers, there's proportionally fewer and fewer of us who've sort of stuck the long-term career journey.
Like, That might be, but I haven't seen evidence of that, because if that was true, literally, this door would be broken down right now by 20 private equity firms and VCs begging me to come and join them. So again, I do think there is a bit of a crunch still, where there's a lot of experience and wonderful people who don't want to take a lesser role and, you know, don't necessarily just want to give up and go to Meta and become like a level 7 manager. And they're looking for something where they could still have, you know, a chance to see a big remit. But the bigger challenge is, to your point, I think generationally, we're going to hit a crisis, because you would learn how to be a good manager of managers and a good strategic leader on the job by either having a great CTO boss who understood that and wasn't one of those old school, you know, just code and IT only CTOs, or you just experience that journey that a company like a Revolut or TransferWise goes through, where you had to grow with the company because you had to evolve or die. And ideally, you got some good coaching along the way from, you know, occasional management training or something like that. So there's a whole generation of people who are just not going to get the right management training, because they're going to be at these very lean orgs, you know, iterating very fastly, but not scaling on the people side, because you could do more with less and investors are giving companies less money. Or you have to really spend a lot of time at a gigantic company like Google or Facebook and hope you've been promoted a couple of times and trained correctly. And so, yeah, and those people are going to come out with no business experience, but good, you know, people and tech management experience at a scale of like 30 or 40 headcount. So I do think that crunch is going to come. You know, what the proudest things in my career is I've had a chance to coach people who are now VPs of engineering, directors of engineering with those size of orgs, you know, and I hope I've been a good influence on them. But those opportunities are going to come by less. There's going to be more of that thing, either stay as a principal with light management responsibilities at small companies, or, you know, grind it out at a bigger company in one of those principal or, you know, engineering management track roles, and less chance to experience the, you know, what I think is the thrill of, you know, having a diverse, reasonably sized organization where there's always something that could be improved and fixed and always somebody you can promote and challenge, while still having, you know, that product tech, you know, digital responsibility for a board and a C-suite.
Absolutely. I mean, let's talk about the ratio of product and tech, because I think that's another thing that's changing fundamentally as well. When I look at the makeup of teams and where the effort is needed at the moment, I'm seeing a big shift, especially in those teams with engineers who are being very forward-leaning with the use of AI, code generation, also with problem understanding, problem breakdown, using, you know, more advanced AI tools like O1 and Claude, Sonnet, to literally take what they need to do and break the steps down further. A single engineer can now do more, generate more code. They can be more productive than they ever could be in the past. Whereas understanding the problem hasn't really moved that far forward. Talking to users, understanding requirements, eliciting the pain points, this hasn't really changed a significant amount. And what I'm seeing, and I'm really curious to see if you see the same thing, is this sort of change in the ratio where, I mean, you mentioned before 20-80 in sort of the number of product people versus the number of engineers, where you've got one product person to sort of 4 to 5 engineers. I'm seeing that sort of shifting more towards parity at the moment, where you kind of need 2 product people to keep up with 2 engineers. And I think it's going to continue shifting in another direction. We'll end up with a situation where you need only 1 engineer, but so many people to try and figure out what it is they need to do, because that engineer can generate code, experiment, iterate, and turn around so fast. There's going to be plenty of people needed to just keep up with customer requirements, understanding the challenges and the data analysis required. Are you seeing something similar? Would you see the way the trend is going in the same way?
Yeah, I absolutely will place my bet that you're going to see even ratios. I don't know if it'll swing quite as far on the other side as you've predicted. But then what's fascinating right now is you've got this one school with this viral founder mode thing, like, oh, Brian Chesky's getting rid of all his PMs because he's realizing they're, and that's not, I think, the mode everybody should be following. And then you see the other side, which, you know, I agree with, you know, put some more product mentality. Like, everywhere I've gone, the answer has almost always been to up the ratio of PMs to engineers to solve some of the longstanding things that look like tech debt, or, you know, a lack of a platform mindset alongside a product mindset. So those interventions have always been the right ones. You know, they were the right in 2019 and 2021, and, you know, they're even more right now with these tools. I just use V0 Vercel to build a front end for the software as a service platform I'm building. And I'm a terrible front end engineer. I would have had to hire a front end contractor, but I know enough to be dangerous, you know, what I need, because I'm a lifelong, you know, CTO engineer. But it just solved all this nuance of knowing the folklore about Yarn and NPM and state managers, the stuff I just was never excited about doing as a coder. So yeah, I do think that's going to change the game massively. On the other hand, yeah, I think this is another difference between possibly a widening gulf between what it's like to iterate in a startup world and what it's like to speak companies. There was on LinkedIn, I actually had the honor of being flamed by the Pragmatic Engineer, blogger, because I said in one of his threads, you know, what about the evolution of no code and low code tools? And he was like, oh, I don't see that happening at all. And at first I was like, you know, he got like 7 likes on it, but I realized his audience is people working their way up through your Google and Facebook, where everything is homegrown. Like, they have a lot of internal platforms and systems. They're not out using HubSpot or you know, Contentful or even, you know, other cloud providers other than their, because they're operating at such a different scale. So many ways, I think there's a forest for the trees. If they had more of a product, they understand they probably are building a lot of internal tools that from other stakeholders actually look like no code, but they don't see their role that way because they're not, their connection between them and the customer is abstracted through so many different departments, all of which need to have, you know, super hot engineering skills in order to build what looks like that tool. But in the real world, yeah, you know, no code, your Zapiers, your Makes, what CRMs can now do, what these like, you know, A-B testing, and now combine that all with code generation. Yeah, I think you're going to need smart people to rework things and to improve, you know, componentry, but everything is going to have that component and tooling mindset, you know, to put together a customer journey, to put together an app offering. It's going to be less about just having this deep, you know, front and back end, you know, classic architecture mindset. And yeah, I think the role of engineers shifting into product roles, you know, because they've gotten bored with just learning the latest framework over and over again, they want to have bigger impact. And product people now being empowered to like design and deploy at a solution end to end, as long as it doesn't break any of the pre-existing architecture or design system that's been built. So if you want to iterate the customer journey three times over a month, you're not tapping two front end devs over the shoulder to rewrite, you know, the controller in the view. Your product manager is just assembling that from the library and tools they have and using the data tools that have been built or generated to measure the funnel, and just less iterative, reactive rework to do that. And I think that's going to be a great thing overall, but it requires the product side of that to really feel empowered to understand the data flow and, you know, componentry, and then the tech side of it to see themselves as almost like a tooling engineer, even for what seem like traditional, you know, front end, back end experience deployment.
Yeah. I'm seeing you using it in even really pragmatic ways as well. So for example, when they need to build an admin interface or an internal tool, I'm seeing basically non-engineering background product people, and even sometimes in some cases designers, using tools to put together entire interfaces and entire admin apps for internal use, which don't need to look amazing. They don't need to look, you know, they don't need to use the latest UX capabilities. They just need to be good enough and therefore not rely on the bottleneck of engineering as well. So that's even before you get to engineers being able to accelerate the rate at which they put up code using, yeah, AI. I mean, we haven't really spoken that much about AI so far. I mean, do you think that AI is going to change the way the industry happens as much as everybody else has been talking about?
I do. And I don't think it's going to be solopreneurs and the death of software engineering as a career anymore, that hopefully it's going to be the death of product management as a career. But the way we think about it, I think, is going to fundamentally change. And I think it shouldn't seem that different from when we went from writing assembly code to compilers, when we went from, you know, deploying manual data centers to have to visit data centers, which I had the pleasure of doing at a different phase of my career, to like deploying in the cloud. You know, I think just where AI capabilities, even if some of the hype dies down with doing, you know, solving everything with like bad chatbots and bad video generators, I don't think the energy efficiency for just generating code better, generating data better, like that stuff is not what's wasting all the, you know, GPUs out there. So once they solve that, yeah, it'll just be the natural way to do things. Nobody wants to go back to writing assembly. I don't think people want to go back to pointer arithmetic, you know, with a C++. So I don't think we're even going to have a lot of love for having to care about Webpack and Yarn, you know, and things like that. That's just should be automatically generated and, you know, solved at a level and abstracted from solving the real business problems and customer problems with a really great digital product.
Yeah. And I think we'll end up with a slightly less big proliferation in the sort of different kinds of software languages in use as well. And the only parallel I've found to that, to be able to try and explain it to people who are not in engineering worlds, is there's only so many things we make bricks and blocks out of these days. Concrete, brick, and a couple of other materials. We're not experimenting with those day in, day out. So I think that'll probably happen the same thing with software languages. You know, we've got a wide range of software languages at the moment with a wide range of paradigms. I suspect we'll end up with a winner in each of those paradigms, and then pretty much we'll coalesce around those over time.
Oh, I could tell you, like, again, I'm not a language geek, but oh my God, it's going to be SQL and JavaScript. It has to be. I mean, literally, like, you cannot write an experience on mobile or front end without using JavaScript at some point, which is why the TypeScript, you know, React frameworks have done so well. You stay in one syntax, whether JavaScript is good or not as a value judgment. You know, it was famously designed by Netscape, you know, in a matter of a day. But because, you know, if you're going around messing with Ruby and, you know, PHP, you still have to write JavaScript to actually get the visual stuff or manage that. Same thing with SQL, all these different data technologies. At the end of the day, even the data warehouses and the other things are going back to a classic, you know, tabular mindset. So I think like the things that have the most endurance are the ones that are just so fundamental. You know, delivering responsive design was always a JavaScript consideration. So that's why more of the full stack has just evolved into it for simplicity's sake. And same thing with, like, you know, whether you are a DBA by trade, which is a role that seems to have kind of gone by the wayside, understanding that kind of data model relational model, you know, has not gone away at all. And, you know, yeah, hopefully the number of people have to understand how to reverse engineer JavaScript in SQL is less and less and just becomes a very specialized thing. But thinking in those terms of mindsets, yeah, I could see that convergence, and it will cut down on a lot of the cognitive overload. And there's no reason why your generative AI shouldn't play a part in accelerating that.
Excellent. Well, while we're on the subject of AI, let's pick up on the big topic of the day. Today's, when we're recording, is 26th of September. And of course, we just found out that Mira Murati has resigned as CTO of OpenAI. So what do you read into that?
I think Sam Altman's now in the school of people like Elon Musk, where nothing revolving around him is surprising or normal. So I don't think there's a lot you could extrapolate that has any relevance to, you know, how we would approach the real world. Is there just in a different circle of like chaos that kind of follows people like that around? So I'm sure Mira will do great and probably found her own company, much like everybody else who's left. But I don't, like, OpenAI is just such a weird thing. Even in the AI ecosystem, it's different than how, you know, Gemini or Llama or Anthropic, you know, operate. So yeah, I don't know. Like, I still use OpenAI probably the most of the 7 or 8 major models, just because I've gotten to a comfort level and using it with Azure, you know, and other things where I'm getting a lot of free, you know, credits. But yeah, I think what the role of a CTO at an AI company is versus a company that's using AI, I think it's going to go back to what we discussed earlier. You know, if you really are competing with the big tech to build, you know, something where you want to be Google size someday, then it's probably more of a scientist role, you know, ultimately. Whereas if you're trying to leverage the capability to just generate the best data-driven, you know, healthcare or, you know, e-commerce or insurance experience or finance experience, I think it's going to be like everything we discussed throughout this call. You know, how do you get that right? AI becomes another tool along with infrastructure, product management, frameworks, you know, data models and thinking about that. And you just, it's another consideration where you have to understand the fundamentals of it, but it's a means to an end, you know, unless you are going to try to build your own competitive model to OpenAI or Gemini.
Absolutely. Well, before we get on to sort of the big forward-looking statements and, you know, what's going to happen next industry, I just want to ask you one question. So as, you know, obviously you're now consulting for certain companies, you've been doing the fractional work. So if you were to advise a CTO who's perhaps in that stage where they're sort of part individual contributor, part strategic management, if you were to give them one critical piece of advice for how to manage themselves going forwards, or one thing that they need to do, what would you say is that key piece of advice from your perspective?
It's get management training, outside management training. Tell your CEO to pay for it. It would cost, you know, $3,000 for a session. It's money well spent if they're worried, you know, about replacing their CTO someday. Get financial training. Understand, you know, become best friends if you're a CFO. Understand how boards and VCs think about spreadsheets and how you fit into that. And continue to get product and design training, you know, whether you do end up in that kind of ideal CPTDO role, you know, or you just want to work better with the designated head of product, which might be your CEO. That is just, you wouldn't have that role if you didn't know your business somewhat. So let's assume you know your tech well enough. You think you've got a good perspective on what good and bad, you know, tech design is and tech architecture is. There's only so much more training that's going to be relevant. Everything is going to be about how to apply it on the people side, on the commercial side, and on the product strategy side. And I think that's like early and often. Like, don't wait for the funding event where suddenly you're told, okay, we got to hire 30 people. We have to restructure the org around that and create new roles. And we have to change the way we do marketing. Like, you don't want to be reactive to all three of those things. You should be forward-thinking and paranoid in a good way enough to be getting way ahead of those what-ifs and, you know, either out-of-pocket investing in it, you know, with your spare time if you find yourself not having to do as much coding, you know, to get things done, or even asking for it boldly, you know, of your CEO and say, this is part of the investment in the future, so you're not replacing this role 3 times at 3 different stages of the journey. Yeah, I think that financial, product, and commercial awareness, that's the gap, particularly for people who've been in IC roles or have gone for middle management roles in larger companies where they just haven't been exposed to that at a board level.
Right. So I try and summarize it down is get yourself skilled in management, finance, the business, essentially, and all those skills are part of the other parts of the C-suite.
Correct. And yeah, a lot of times it's like they want to learn from you. Try to be a good teacher and make sure you're not just speaking jargon to them or explaining why something can't happen soon enough, but really try to challenge them. Like, you know, some of my best moments are not only when a CMO or COO challenged me, but when I could actually tell them they weren't being ambitious enough. There was a much better way to do cohort reporting to get PPC better, but let's make this quick investment to do it. I think it goes back to another bugaboo of mine. Like, if you see a job description for a CTO and they want a tech roadmap that's different from the product roadmap, unless, again, this is Just Eat or, you know, Google, that is nonsense. Like, that is literally being set up for failure. You're going to have like a box ticking exercise to talk about when you're shifting your infrastructure or you're going to move from ECS to Kubernetes. Boards do not care about that. And that's going to be the first thing on the chopping block when like ruthless product delivery. But like most tech debt, if it really is a question of better infrastructure, better cloud usage, better changing to a more JavaScript and moving away from a PHP, all those should be tied to clear commercial capabilities. Like, I want to expand into another geography, so fixing the way we do deployment and localization now becomes part of that commercial initiative. I want to be able to handle a partner 10 times our size, and it's going to be silly to use the same cloud deployment tool, but it has to be tied to those commercial milestones. So yeah, I would both be leery. I would challenge even coming into the job in the interview, why do you think there should be a separate tech rep? I mean, risk, if they're dead set on that, they've got the wrong mindset. And if you can't influence that as part of your role, it might not be the right role for you until they go through the hard learning. But as an example of, again, almost being encouraged to think purely in a vertical tech sense and much less in a horizontal business sense. And again, the problem is not just CTOs who don't think to do that if they're not challenged, but other C-suites and founders and CEOs who don't think to challenge their incoming or prospective CTO on that.
Yeah. Brilliant. As somebody who does coaching, that's music to my ears. I absolutely love that. And let's very quickly then look forward. So what do you think is going to happen in the industry over the next, I mean, let's look at it, the role of the CTO. What do you think the role of the CTO is going to be in say, 5 or 10 years' time? Real crystal ball stuff here.
Yeah, my hope is that it's a wider role, that there's less of this, we need a CPO and CTO at every stage of the business, that people are more comfortable converging, you know, in their careers. CPO is taking on a CTO role with the right training and, you know, vice versa. So there's just less executive clutter over, you know, what is going to probably be a more efficient people operation. But then within that, really thinking about team topologies, I think it's just going to take on a very different, it has to be, again, very product minded, but also people minded. Like you said, you could end up overseeing an org with 10 teams of 3 each. So you've got to understand the, you know, that kind of remit that you're overseeing 10 teams at a much earlier stage in the company's evolution, but you're actually managing a much smaller budget and really understanding how that's going to drive the right ROI. And really not being stuck flat-footed, you know, with kind of outdated thinking about what sort of roles you need to execute and what sort of internal home-built tools you need versus using the right commodity tools, you know, whether it's AI or CRM, you know, et cetera. I think that's already in play, but I think it's going to become even more important, particularly if you come into one of these transformation roles where you're inheriting a private equity thing, you know, then you've got the both problems where you're trying to get them to adopt a new mindset, but these are people who've come through the rapid, you know, rise and fall of 3 or 4 startups, you know, in the last 10 years of their career. So I think bringing that education back to these kind of private equity or legacy investments, you're going to see a lot more of that because, yeah, funding is going to go wider. I think there's going to be less Series C funding. There's going to be more seed and Series A funding. So if you want to play in that sandbox, I think being trained to do it right, being empowered to do a wider role so you can, you know, not be bored or feel squozing out of a job at that point. But then I think going deeper into legacy businesses and digitizing them, there's still so much headroom on banks, insurance, and, you know, that is going to come to a head at some point. Like, I don't think they're just going to go and make the same mistakes, you know, with a new generation of private equity they were making 10 or 20 years ago and expect that it costs, you know, $100 million to do a six month migration and pay a McKinsey, you know, $3 million to tell them how to do it, but then not be there to actually do it. I hope that whole how we think about consulting and legacy and private equity changes becomes more progressive and adopts more to the learnings from a lot of these startups.
That'll be interesting to see. And finally, as somebody who's always sort of been at the forefront of change, what do you look forward to as a sort of your next challenge to tackle for yourself in your own career?
Yeah, I'd say it's the most interesting time I've had in my career, you know, where I don't know if I want to be a founder. You know, I haven't been a founding CEO, which is why I am incubating a thing. Would that be the next logical step for me to take? Or I still think there's a lot of hay to be made with the right chief digital officer, you know, chief product technology officer for the right organization. And so I think there's another branding challenge. Like, everybody's trying to use, you know, and people should be using LinkedIn and, you know, thinking about their content brand, doing podcasts. I think it's a great way to learn. It's a great way to teach. But I think people need to be tolerant of that ambiguity. Like, you're always asked to live with ambiguity if you want to go join a startup, if you want to lead a startup, you know, but somehow there's still this, and oh, you have that one story, you have that one niche, you know, you're the world's best fractional CTO, you're the world's best full-time CTO, you're the world's best solopreneur. But the reality is people are going to have to balance those things and understand, you know, when to take the risk sideways or diagonally, when to just take the risk straightforward. And I think people need to, you know, I wonder what kind of brand I put on LinkedIn that I'm saying I'm a leader and an entrepreneur and I'm an advisor. And, you know, I'll hear one school say, oh, you can only pick one lane and do it so well, otherwise you'll fail. And I just think that doesn't really jive with the reality we're all facing, that we're in a rapidly changing time where the expectations and the needs are changing. And I think being at the forefront of that, you do have to market yourself a few different ways and almost, you know, test your branding while still remaining true to what you're passionate about. And for me, that is building great products with great people, you know, using technology. and whether I'm doing that as a software as a service CEO, you know, bootstrapped or venture back, whether I'm doing it as a scale up CTO or CPO, whether I'm doing it as a fractional advisor, that's what gets me excited. I don't get excited just by fixing Python bugs or, you know, playing with the absolute latest CI/CD tooling.
Cool. And Todd, if somebody wants to get in touch with you and one of the listeners wants to do that, and how can they reach you?
Well, there's only one Todd Zeno, as far as I could tell, on the internet or LinkedIn. But I really encourage, I will get coffee with anybody in London. Nobody's too junior or too senior for me to explore, you know, coffee and learn what motivates them, what keeps them up at night about their career or about the leadership choices they're making with their company. I live for that. It's something I learned from my co-founder when we were so busy with Wallaby, always stopped three or four times a week to get coffee with like MBAs looking to start a business or people used to work with at legacy companies, you know, who were frustrated. And I've been doing that, you know, especially with now I have more time as a fractional and like bootstrapping. That's just very important to me. And I never blow people off unless they're clearly running a scam or, you know, trying to sell you some service you don't need, you know, in a different geography. But yeah, I think I'm always available for networking, particularly if you're in London. We can do it face-to-face. And I would love to talk to more entrepreneurs and VCs who are in this struggle of understanding what a CTO is and what they need versus what they've been told they need.
Yeah. Excellent. Brilliant. Well, I mean, I think as being able to help people figure out what the next future of the role looks like and where it needs to go for any particular scenario is always worthwhile. Todd, thanks so much. I will make sure I put the link in the show notes so people know how to reach you on LinkedIn. And yeah, the future never pans out as we expect, does it? But it's always fun to explore it. So thank you very much for spending the time with me today. I've really enjoyed that conversation.
Yes, thank you for having me. It's been great to discuss this from so many different angles in such a efficient period of time. So thank you. It's an honor.
Thanks so much. Until next time, folks, stay innovative and keep leading with impact. Thank you very much for listening all the way through to the end. Just before you go, I'd like to ask you for one thing in return for putting together all these episodes of the CTO Playbook podcast for you. Please leave a review. Wherever you're listening, whether that is Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whichever platform you're on, leaving a quick review will help more CTOs find the podcast and enable me to create more great episodes. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode of the CTO Playbook.